Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of 91.7 KALW, local and innovative public radio for San Francisco.
We're continuing conversations that begin at Stanford University, and in this case, at the Stanford Humanities Center, co-sponsor of today's show. Our guest, Daniel Hurwitz, was a fellow there, and is returning this weekend to participate in a conference about knowledge and belief celebrating the Humanities Center's 25th anniversary.
You can find out more about this conference at the website, shc.stanford.edu. And while you're there, you can migrate over to our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where this conversation will continue.
Ken, today's topic is reconciliation, and what we have in mind is mainly not reconciliation between two obnoxious people like you or me, but between warring elements in a country, the kind of thing involved in South Africa's reconciliation project. But what exactly does reconciliation mean?
Well, you start with people who have been at odds. Maybe one group, the dominant group, has committed lots of atrocities against the subdominant group. Maybe the subdominant group has used terrorist tactics to fight and has done some atrocities in return. And it's over. That period is gone, and they're trying to rebuild, reconstitute anew, and they've got to get on with it somehow. So instead of, like, everybody taking revenge or retribution on everybody else, they reconcile by some process.
By some process. So from the time after reconciliation, they should coexist in harmony, if not exactly be fast friends. But I have a little trouble understanding what's supposed to be the relationship between reconciliation and classical conceptions like justice. Are they alternatives? Let's not worry about justice. Let's reconcile and get on with it. Or is reconciliation somehow a sequel to justice?
Well, or it could be that reconciliation is like a part of justice. Our guest, Daniel Hurwitz, is going to join us, and he has this nice phrase, transitional justice, right? I mean, you might think, well, look, first, you did the bad thing to me, so I want to exact some retribution. He's not going to get away scot-free, but then maybe it wouldn't be as bad as it otherwise was, especially if you have some kind of penance, right? You fess up, and I give you some kind of amnesty, and then after you fessed up, and I've got my retribution, we can go on. We can reconcile. So maybe it's like a stage-wise thing, and it's all part of one big process.
Maybe it's a new conception of justice, but it has its roots, I suppose, in the individual case, where we use words like forgiveness, penance, retribution. One person has to reconcile with someone who's done them harm because they're going to live in the same community, maybe in the same family. So maybe some attention to the individual case would help us understand the social case.
Well, I think you're right about that, and our roving philosophical reporter, Amy Standen, went out and talked to someone who achieved a degree of reconciliation. She files this report.
My uncle was the youngest of my grandmother's children. My cousin was the oldest of her grandchildren. For me, that feels significant somehow.
Pat Clark is the director of the Fellowship for Reconciliation. When she was a child, Clark's uncle and then 6 months later her cousin were murdered.
There are those in her family who were absolutely ready to seek vengeance. There are those who were just overwhelmed by grief and were paralyzed by that grief. But the response that probably had the greatest impact on me was the response of my grandmother, a deeply spiritual woman, who basically said that, you know, it's not ours to seek revenge, that ultimately God will make this right.
One of the murderers was brought to justice and later reconciled with the family. But the other one, the woman who killed Clark's uncle, was never punished.
I think the conditions for reconciliation are having an understanding and an acknowledgement of what happened, number one, and some sense of accountability, but also basically making a commitment to moving forward in a different way. And again, that doesn't mean you become fast friends, but it does mean that a willingness to look at things through different perspectives, a willingness to struggle through issues, and most importantly, I think, a different appreciation for the humanity of people who you view as different. I think reconciliation in my family situation gave us a sense of, first of all, not being defined by this terrible, actually two very terrible tragedies. I think it also gave us a sense of the value of all life and the need to hold it sacred. You know, forever and ever, we will be connected to the woman who killed my uncle, and we'll be connected to the man who killed my first cousin. Because you can hardly think of either of those people in our families without thinking about what happened to them. So I think part of reconciliation is about, do we want to, you know, have that connection always be one that's, you know, filled with anger and hate? We knew the woman who killed my uncle. We knew the man who killed my first cousin. We knew their families. Good people. You know, and so I think there was also this recognition that even with good people, bad things can happen. You know, I have two nephews and a niece that I'm raising, and, you know, I've done the best job that I can do. I think they're wonderful, affectionate, caring individuals, but I can't guarantee what their life's paths will be. So if they're engaged in something that's wrong or, God forbid, horrible, I hope that folks who are judging them will have some grace in that judgment. And so that's why, you know, focusing on reconciliation is so important to me, is because we don't know when we're going to be in situations where we may react in ways that, you know, are totally antithetical to who we think we are and who we think we're about. And if we do, I would hope that there would be some grace somewhere where people could see us not as defined by that one event, but see the totality of who we are as human beings.
For Philosophy Talk, this is Amy Standen.
Thanks, Amy, for that piece. A somber story of death with the bright spot of reconciliation. Themes of grace and the idea that reconciliation rests on the fundamental insight that the evil that people do is more a part of human nature than something special about them. It's part of all of us.
Yeah, and maybe it's just moral luck that some of us don't do that evil. Maybe it's just the circumstances in which we find ourselves. I'm Ken Taylor, along with John Perry. We're joined, our guest today is Daniel Hurwitz. He's the director of the Institute for the Humanities at the University of Michigan. He's author of a very nice book that I've been reading recently. It's called Race and Reconciliation, Essays from the New South Africa. And Daniel's a participant in the Humanities Center Conference on Knowledge and Belief this weekend at the Stanford campus at the Humanities Center.
Daniel, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be part of the show. And if I may say so, Ken and I shared a graduate program half a world away and many years back. And it's not a reconciliation to be talking to him. It's just a wonderful new occasion after a long time.
Well, that's good to hear. Now, after graduate school, you were in South Africa during the reconciliation process. As a matter of fact, you were chair of the philosophy department and director of the Center for Knowledge and Innovation at the University of Natal. Why don't you begin by telling us a little bit about your experience as a philosophy professor in the middle of this big reconciliation process?
I went to South Africa in 96 to be part of what could be called a public life in a moment of transition. I had been in California and saw the opportunity of being part of that society. My wife was a returning South African, wanted very much to be part of things when apartheid ended, and so we went. And we found ourselves embroiled in an immensely complicated set of events, a huge set of events, which were dignified and wonderful and awesome and difficult, and if I may say so, philosophical. Because we began to realize early on that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the new constitution, the great events of state formation, whereby a formerly fascist dictatorship was becoming democratic, were filled with philosophy, with the pages of philosophy. The very idea of reconciliation is indeed a kind of Christian philosophical projection onto a set of events. We had warring parties, the African National Congress at war with the National Party. We had the most profound system of geographical racism imaginable, the consignment of people of color to the rural areas and so forth. These people were never reconciled to begin with. It's not a reconciliation. They are being brought together for the first time. And yet the concept brought over from Christianity is one which says, you were one in the old times. You have come apart. Now you may come back together again. It projects.
Daniel, you say brought over from Christianity, but I don't remember the word reconciliation occurring too much in the New Testament. What what body of concepts are you thinking of there?
I'm thinking of the reconciliation of the three parts of Christ, through Christ, Christ, man, and the Holy Spirit, and so forth. At the end of history, it becomes a secularization of Christianity through Hegel, and Hegel's idea in 18th century, writing at the moment of national formation, is that once you have a state in place with a constitution that is just and fair and equitable, once you have the institutions of the state, law and society, civil society, once you have new universities,
people are now
ready to reconcile with the state.
You're moving pretty fast there. Let's go back to South Africa. Let's suppose I'm a black South African who's pretty much seen my party destroyed, my leaders put in prison, my relatives killed.
My land taken. Turned into a landless mine worker or something like that.
Marginalized in every way, forced to learn this Afrikaans language. Now, what's my motive for reconciliation? I mean, and what does it involve?
Especially when that old state is crumbling and it looks like my side is going to emerge the victor in that crumbling. Why should I reconcile rather than exact retribution and move on in that way?
I'm sure that they didn't say, well, this is because of something Hegel said. I mean, what did they say to these people that gave them a motive?
Yeah, the underground.
The underground,
the real life, everyday, moving force. What moved the South African polity?
You know, reconciliation needs to be understood as a particular process established by a certain commission. There were many people, if you read J.M. Coetzee's book, Disgrace, who did not reconcile with one another. The reason why you need a truth commission is to spearhead a process that many people are ambivalent about, so that they can find a set of symbols in which they can find exemplification and want to go along. Many people did not reconcile. There is profound crime, there is profound hatred, lingering racism, etc. What there was a process that became possible. It is called a truth commission. And truth commissions are crucial at moments of transitional justice as a way of spearheading populations into reconciliation.
So this is something that came from a kind of vanguard, an elite vanguard that said, this is how we shall build a new South Africa. We will have this Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and that will be our instrument for trying to build a new South Africa?
The Truth and Reconciliation Commission came right out of the constitutional process. The first constitution was articulated in 1994. Apartheid ends in 1991. There are 2 years of negotiation between Nelson Mandela and de Klerk, the National Party. On the one hand, de Klerk, Mandela, the African National Congress. They lead to a process whereby democratic elections are set up for the first time in 94, and an interim constitution is produced in 94. In that constitution was mandated the terms of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which would do three things. It would investigate the profound and odious and brutal human rights violations of the apartheid past. It would allow for a mixture of punishment and amnesty for perpetrators who disclosed fully the truth about their crimes and who met certain kinds of criteria would be given a qualified amnesty. Others would be punished and subject to imprisonment. And very importantly, victims who had never had a voice in the old society, who were disenfranchised in every possible way, would have a voice before this commission. They could speak. And the first impetus to involvement was the impetus to speak, that a public forum in South Africa for the first time would listen.
Okay, so look, I'm going to ask you to think about this. Look, truth, amnesty, reconciliation, that's a kind of a trinity. And I want to understand how this trinity kind of fits together kind of conceptually. I mean, is it necessary? A reconciliation and truth necessarily a pair, right? But we'll ask you about that after the break. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our topic, reconciliation. Our guest is Daniel Hurwitz.
We've talked about what reconciliation is, particularly in the South African context, and a little bit about whether it's just. We'll return to those topics and also ask what sorts of things can stand in the way of reconciliation after the break. You can join us at 415-841-4134.
Justice, reconciliation, and your call when Philosophy Talk continues. Thank you.
sad, so sad with the sad, sad situation. And it's getting more and more absurd. It's sad,
so sad,
so sad. Why can't we talk it over? Oh, it seems to me that sorry seems to be the hardest word.
Elton John and Sorry Seems to Be the Hardest Word. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Today on Philosophy Talk, reconciliation. Join us. The number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
Outside the Bay Area, call toll-free at 1-800-525-9917. You can also email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. So what do you think out there in Radio Land? Is reconciliation realistic in situations like Iraq or Northern Ireland, or even some of the reconciling that still needs to go on in our country as between Native Americans and blacks and dominant majorities?
Our guest today is Daniel Horowitz, director of the Institute for Humanities at the University of Michigan. Daniel, I want to explore this trinity that you talked about. Truth, reconciliation, and amnesty. Is it that, I mean, one might think that you can't have reconciliation until you have like a full airing of the truth, and then you grant amnesty, and then that's somehow instrumental to reconciliation. But I take it that's not yet the achievement of reconciliation. Just talk to me a bit about how those three things were supposed to go together in South Africa, in fact went together, you know, conceptually go together.
Those truth commissions where there isn't the specter of punishment as part of the process, as in Chile, where there was a blanket amnesty given in advance, have tended to be far less effective in promoting national reconciliation because everybody understood that it was lacking in a certain kind of force, that power was not really at stake. The thing about a truth commission is that it has to be fighting wrong with a certain kind of power, and power tends to involve justice as punishment, the specter of imprisoning the bad guys. However, if indeed a truth commission is just about punishment, it won't lead to reconciliation because it doesn't have the idea of forgiveness, the idea of harmony, the idea of a certain kind of rapprochement that might take place. It was through the magnificent figure of Bishop Tutu with his seven rings and his beautiful crimson robes and his sparkling effervescence that this process could take shape, where Tutu actually, at the end of a process whereby truth was articulated, meaning crimes were acknowledged, the real record was established, people admitted. He actually brought people where they could embrace or shake hands. Some might find that repulsive. Indeed, some South Africans opted out of the process. Many did not find it repulsive.
Daniel, let me interrupt you for a second. So if I was a perpetrator of an evil deed, if I just said, I did it, then I was granted amnesty?
You needed full disclosure of the crime, first of all. And full disclosure really means full disclosure. There was a commission researching into crimes. It was always difficult how to figure out whether enough information was enough, but people were pretty good at it. The problem with that process is that some of the bad guys really do go through who shouldn't go through. So that there was a murderer called Jeffrey Benzin, who famously used to perform a water torture. He would put people in a bath and put a plastic bag over their head and torture them to confess. And in order to grant amnesty, a person has to give full disclosure he did of the things that he had done, as far as everybody knew. But the criteria of amnesty also involves something called proportionality. You had to be able to convince the Truth Commission that what you had done was in the service of a genuine political end, like, for example, shooting up a house because you thought there was a suspected terrorist, as opposed to raping a child, which nobody could argue served any kind of political end. So Benzin successfully argued that putting people's heads in the water and putting plastic over their heads and choking them nearly to death served the political end of getting information. It became a kind of scandal. No process is perfect. However, if you don't allow for punishment on the one hand and an amnesty on the other, reconciliation is hard to imagine at the end of the process.
Daniel, as I hear it, earlier you said there is this break between things for which there is amnesty as possible, given truth, and things that are beyond the pale. And sometimes they made mistakes. as it sounds like they did in this case. But what was the kind of philosophical criteria for what's beyond the pale?
The philosophical criteria came from this criteria adopted from international law of proportionality.
Oh, I see.
The idea being that whatever you did had to be somehow measurable as something with a clear utilitarian political end. May I just go on?
Right, so you don't have to justify the end. You just have to explain that, given that political end, which this made sense.
Yes. Yeah. It was really there to exclude certain kinds of things that everybody knew had nothing to do with politics. The raping of children, the shooting up of entire families, things of that nature, for which it seemed repulsive and odious to everybody that any kind of amnesty should be offered.
Okay, Daniel.
That's really the point of the criteria.
Daniel, I think I've got learning readiness for something that you brought up earlier. You went over there after being a graduate student at the University of Chicago, and I know you didn't have a lot of Hegel there. And something there convinced you that Hegel's ideas really helped you understand his process. Tell me a little bit about that, and keep in mind that I know very little about Hegel, and Ken knows even less.
No, I know more about Hegel than you do.
I hear you. What convinced me was that this was a society that was setting up the institutions of democracy. It was in the process of transition, articulating a new and just constitution. By the way, in the interim constitution, reconciliation was written into the preamble that a constitution was part of a process of reconciliation. It was setting up a constitution, changing the courts of law. We were remaking universities, trying to bring in huge numbers of Zulu and Xhosa students through the process, trying to build up a middle class. What Hegel had understood was that reconciliation requires social justice, and social justice only makes sense when you're doing all those things. And so Hegel became applicable in my own thinking to a society at this moment of transition to democracy. That's the idea.
Because you're like the Hegelian dialectic between the dominator and the dominated kind of thing, the master and the slave depending upon each other, and then the master realizing that he depends on the slave, so he's not the fully master, and the slave, you know, has skills and capacities that the master depends on, and so the slave realizing that he's not a mere slave, he's not a mere instrument, because he has something that that the whole kind of thing you're thinking about there?
Okay, Ken, I grant you know a lot more about Hegel than I do.
What was going on was that, indeed, in Hegel, there is a situation of injustice, and the situation is the master dominating the slave. Each one realizes that they can't somehow fulfill the process because they need the other person. And through that, they come to realize that a better way, indeed the only way to get along, is to set up institutions of equality. At that point, international law becomes articulated, a constitution becomes articulated, fairness in the social justice becomes articulated, then reconciliation can happen. Right. In South Africa, let me just finish. Interestingly enough, in 1987, both sides, the National Party and the ANC, began to realize neither was going to win in an armed conflict. And so it was like each one realized the only alternative was to get along.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking to Daniel Hurwitz about reconciliation. You can join our discussion by calling 415-841-4134 or outside the Bay Area, 1-800-525-9917. And Stephen from San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Stephen.
Yes, hi. I wanted to talk about the idea behind the Reconciliation Commission. I studied with Justice Richard Goldstone, and he was integral in creating that with the ANC. And what he had to say, and he underlined this point a number of times, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was the product of political compromise. The apartheid administration did not want to send all the members of the de Klerk administration to jail wholesale. And that was a deal breaker for them to transition to real democracy. And so they came up with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission not as a great moral decision, but instead a compromise, because the leadership of the ANC really wanted real justice and a full examination and actual jailing of the people who perpetrated the crimes of apartheid.
Stephen, that's thanks for the call. Daniel, that raises a question. In your book, you talk about transitional justice. Stephen said something about real justice, as if this transitional justice is a second best thing or something. Just so expand on the idea of whether reconciliation and justice are really incompatible alternatives, whether reconciliation is just a second best thing when you can't get real justice. Tell me what you think.
What Stephen said is absolutely true. What mandated the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was a compromise between two warring parties. However, given that it was set up the way it was, it became possible for it to have moral value and the value of a certain kind of image of reconciliation, so that it was possible, because there was both punishment and amnesty, for people to feel that a society was changing. Now, it becomes crucial to think of truth and reconciliation process as part of justice, because it's part of the way a society in transition is moving towards a circumstance where people are going to be willing to live with one another in the new society. That is its goal. And to do that, it needs to acknowledge the wrongs. It needs to give victims a voice. It needs to feel that there is a record of the past for the future, a kind of moral script, never should it happen again, etc. All of those things will allow it to move on. This is part of the process of establishing justice. However, were it not for the fact that a constitution was simultaneously being articulated, that elections had taken place, that a government the majority of people trusted was in power, none of this could have happened. So it is part of a larger process.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about reconciliation with Daniel Hurwitz from the University of Michigan. You can join our discussion by calling 415-841-4134 or outside the Bay Area, 1-800-525-9917. Last but not least, you can send us email at comments@philosophytalk.org. Greg in Berkeley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Greg.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me. I wanted to talk about reconciliation rooted in the Christian framework as it's related to South Africa. I know that the religious affiliation of a vast majority of the apartheid regime was the Dutch Reformed Church, which theologically justified apartheid and its brutality. And I understand that that particular denomination has since reversed that belief. And my question is, you know, how has the church fared since then after such a huge reversal of doctrine? And how does the reinvented Dutch Reformed Church reconcile with its past? And is it still a legitimate faith, you know, organization?
Daniel, that's a question for you.
Yeah, 2 points. Number one, the Dutch Reformed Church was not as central to the Truth and Reconciliation Project as the Anglican Church. Tutu was the Anglican Archbishop in Cape Town. The Anglican Church had always been a kind of liberal opposer of the apartheid state, always speaking in the name of social justice. Secondly, of all the various churches that were brought up before the Truth and Reconciliation Commission during the process, the one which refused to say anything about its own wrong was the Dutch Reformed Church. It was recalcitrant to the end. It has since begun to change, but its role in South African life is relatively minor. And let us point out the most important thing of all, the black churches. Christianity is an Africanized thing since the 18th century, even earlier. All kinds of apostolic churches, black celebrations, ways in which Africans have created and recreated Christianity, those fed into this process most profoundly. Religion is a joint endeavor of the South African society.
Daniel, I want to ask you another kind of question. We've talked about truth and amnesty and the conditions, the kind of things for which the South Africans would grant amnesty. But I take it that telling the truth, the full truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth, I guess, and being granted amnesty in return, that's not yet reconciliation. I mean, there's got to be something more than that, right? I mean, what's the next step in this? I mean, what is the next step to actually achieving this thing in a concrete way?
The crucial aspect of a truth and reconciliation at a moment of social transition is that it announces the trumpet call of reconciliation. Images of the rainbow nation were in place then, of harmony. They were crucial to the process so that citizens at war, citizens divided by hatred, could come to reimagine their relations to one another differently and in a better way. However, all that being said, early on in the process, Thabo Mbeki, current state president of South Africa, had a huge fight with Desmond Tutu, saying that, in fact, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission only goes so far. There are still two nations economically divided, essentially black and white. And until that changes, the idea of a larger reconciliation becomes a sham. there's something, a great deal to that. It's crucial that at a certain moment, people look at the image, the rainbow of reconciliation. However, at a certain point, people then begin to lose that language and get on with it. They want goods and services. They want justice.
You know, we've been talking about reconciliation in South Africa here on Philosophy Talk with Daniel Hurwitz. After the break, we'll want to turn to the question of the prospects for reconciliation in other circumstances, places like Iraq, for example. And, you know, we'll want to hear more from you.
Yeah. And you can join this discussion by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And John in San Francisco's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, John.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Well, I'll use that segue to ask a question about reconciliation on an individual level between a transgressor and a victim. And it seems to me they're just focusing on the victim. We're asking for forgiveness from that victim. And as a process of that or a part of that, it seems that mourning and mourning the loss, because any transgression, there's some sort of loss that has happened. How in South Africa and in other situations do we come around or support the process for the victim of mourning the loss, going through that, and actually being able at an individual level with a transgressor of being able to actually forgive them?
The extraordinary thing about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was how many African victims testifying claimed, and one believed them, that the process had in some sense freed them to move on. They could never really recover from the loss of husband, the loss of child, the loss of friend. However, the process had allowed them to identify where the bodies were. It had allowed them to speak the difficulty, to hear what finally happened so that they could have closure. That is, in effect, a process of mourning. The very recitation of the report that the commission gave has a long section, almost like Myelin's memorial, 35 pages or more, just the names of the dead. It reads like a public memorial in granite, if you will. The process is filled with that, even though people finally can never get over such things.
Now that's very moving, Daniel. That's very moving. And it makes me think that the process of amnesty and truth in itself is a good thing. I still wonder about moving beyond that and achieving kind of concrete reconciliation. You write in your book about how South Africa is engaged in a furious, feverish process of reconfiguring their lives together, rethinking race, rethinking all sorts of things, right? And I just wonder, you know, whether, I mean, I would think that real reconciliation is at the end of that process, not at the beginning. But I'll ask you more about that.
I think that's absolutely right. And one thing to say is there will never be proper reconciliation until there is parity in the workplace. Because as Voltaire wonderfully shows at the end of Candide, people finally get along when they all realize they can work in the garden together and they can produce something through cooperation. And so there are a series of ways in which, and that requires economics, it requires jobs, it requires a middle class, education, etc.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing reconciliation with Daniel Hurwitz.
When we come back, we'll talk about the conditions for the reconciliation process being possible. Do they exist in Iraq? Do they exist anywhere except some special situation like South Africa? Give us a call at 415-841-4134.
What are the conditions for the possibility of reconciliation when Philosophy Talk continues?
Because I knew I
Anita Baker and I Apologize. I'm John Perry. I offer no apology for that. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. And I'm unapologetically Ken Taylor. We're discussing reconciliation with Daniel Hurwitz. Join us by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
Outside the Bay Area, call toll-free 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. And all around the world, you can email us, comments@philosophytalk.org.
So, Daniel, I want to take you, I want to broaden this discussion beyond South Africa for a little bit. You've thought really hard about the South African context. Are there any lessons there for the world at large? I mean, there are all these divided people still in the world, right, who are terribly at odds with one another. There's the Shiites, the Kurds, the Sunnis. I mean, is there any kind of general lesson we can learn?
Thank you very much for that. Two lessons at least. One of them is, it's only when people realize, and actually, Ken, you're the one who said it, when they realize that the master-slave situation is no longer viable, when they are ready to give it up. So, in Iraq, only if Shiite and Sunni were at a point where each realized there was no alternative to genuine cooperation, rather than mistrust of the process, a wanting out, a wanting some piece of an autonomous something or other. So long as there was a mutually agreeable set of terms for context, reconciliation doesn't even arise. Indeed, a decent constitution doesn't even arise.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Let me ask you. Reconciliation, we talked about its roots in Christian theology. One of our problems in the world today is the unreconciled Muslim populace. They're unreconciled with each other. They're unreconciled with the West. Is there anything in Islam, in Islamic theology, that could be the basis of a kind of theology of reconciliation?
I'm sad to say I'm the wrong guy to answer that. I just don't know. But I think that it's crucial to ask philosophically to what extent reconciliation is indeed something that is the purview of, how should I put it, Judeo-Christian cultures, like South Africa, where, as the gentleman asked earlier and said, the Christian religion was crucial in the formation of the place, where Bishop Tutu was the great Anglican father figure, if you will, and so forth. It's very interesting to ask whether China and Japan want something called reconciliation. What that means, they surely want perhaps some kind of political rapprochement about the past, about the Japanese damage in northern China during the war, Second World War, and so forth. I don't know whether those cultures actually think in terms of reconciliation in the same way that a South Africa does or not, or what the equivalent concept would be. But it would be a philosophical exercise to ask, because it asks you really to think about how universal this concept is, what its purview is. I will say one other thing, though. Cultures need, if they're going to be viable nations, to be at the point where warring parties can accept a common constitution and can accept that getting along has no real alternative.
But see, you said something in passing. You said it's when the parties recognize there is no alternative, when the master can no longer dominate the slave and the slave recognizes that he's something more than a mere slave. But it's hard for parties to get to that because, you know, I mean, that's only at a time of stalemate. Is it only at a time of stalemate that reconciliation between divided peoples, warring factions, is possible? I mean, can there ever be these moments when we're not at stalemate and we seek reconciliation?
The adventure and difficulty of history is that there's no formula for when it's going to happen. That's actually what I think. Everyone was astonished that it happened in South Africa. Everyone in South Africa was astonished that it could happen. We can explain it in retrospect, but the factors are so specific. Had the Soviet Union not collapsed and communism no longer been a viable option, there could have been no reconciliation. Had the National Party not realized that the currency was going down the tubes because of massive devaluation, had business not been at a point, et cetera, et cetera. These are specific conditions which allowed the negotiation, the real politics, to become possible, which led to the reconciliation. The extent to which those are transferable anywhere else or what the criteria are, it proves to me that American Wagnerianism in politics, the idea that you can predict in advance, well, in Iraq, we're going to get it done, we have no idea what's actually going to produce a context in which that will become possible. And I think that's a kind of skeptical truth that philosophy can offer.
I should interject that prediction isn't always so impossible, because lots of people that I know predicted before we went into Iraq that roughly what happened would happen. But so it's rosy predictions that we should be skeptical about, I think.
Gary and Arinda.
Fair enough.
Gary and Arinda's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Gary.
Hi. I have to say that this is not the first time in the world that a conflict has ended and that two sides have buried the hatchet and gone on together. What bothers me is this particularly new agey, this psychobabblish, if you will, about reconciliation. This is something which is... It really belongs. It sounds like it's something that belongs in some kind of a Al-Anon meeting or something like that.
Well, I appreciate that point, but give us an example, a historical example that you think is a good counterpoint to the South African one.
Well, how about in France after World War II? Was there a so-called psychobabbly Truth and Reconciliation Commission with the French that were loyal to French, as opposed to the French who, by and large, just swarmed to help out the occupiers? I mean, when it was over, it was over. Boom. It was finished. It was done. You got to reconcile yourself.
Wasn't there a lot of people with shaved heads running around for a while there?
The failure of such a commission in France post-war was related to the ongoing and lingering profound anti-Semitism, the refusal of the society, even up to Mitterrand, to acknowledge the full force of it needed a Max Ophuls to make films about it in order to get that public out, that public information out. So that was really a failure of France, if I may say so.
Thanks, Gary. But Danny, there is a deeper point there, I think. I'm not sure I agree with the dismissive tone, but there is a deeper point. You said truth and reconciliation. You know, now... You and John and I are all academics, and we live in an arena in which everybody swears their allegiance to seeking the truth. In politics everywhere, the mechanisms aren't mostly set up to pursue truth. And in nation building, in forming a collective, there's so many myths, so many lies. Yeah. And they serve our purpose. They serve our purpose in some ways. We imagine a fictional national identity. So I don't know, maybe, these mechanisms are just more mechanisms for more self-serving lies.
So you're suggesting a more general process might be myth and reconciliation.
Right. That's what I thought.
It's crucial to a truth and reconciliation process that a lot of people don't buy into it, because otherwise it does become reconciliation in this psychobabbly, illusional concept that was actually described by the caller. That actually is a danger of the process and was a danger of Tutu's involvement, actually, in which he used to get up all the time and say at the end of a hair-raising commission in which people talked about the most horrendous violence, he would get up and say, doesn't this all prove that it's such a beautiful country and we are a beautiful country? And after a while, you wanted to say, shut up, let's get on with it. And quite frankly, it was important that the family of Steve Biko, the great black consciousness leader who was brutally murdered by the apartheid authorities in the early 80s and then they denied it, that family refused to be part of the process because it put the process in perspective. It can go so far and no further. It's why reconciliation, I think, arises at certain historical moments and is inevitably imperfect.
So the truth part. Our political process, is there any political process anywhere that actually, reliably tracks the truth? Isn't politics about, serving this interest, telling this story that justifies your position here, his position there? The victim always tells a story. I mean, there's competing narratives, right? Competing
yes.
narratives of history. My narrative is always going to make me come out best. I deserve the good. I don't deserve the bad. Your narrative is going to make you come out best. You deserve the good. I don't know how there could be truth
it is because
in
it is
politics.
Because you're absolutely right, Ken. It is because politics is inevitably historical, rhetorical. It's inevitably about power. It inevitably slants and spins. I mean, in this country, if you could make Kerry, who was thrice decorated in Vietnam, look like a bad guy, anything could be spun. There is no fact that can't be spun into its opposite. The most extraordinary thing. Given that, it's crucial that there be an autonomous civil society in which commissions can be set up that are relatively immune from politics because the people aren't chosen by government, the commissioners are chosen by independent processes, etc. That is called civil society. And that's really the mark of a good democracy, because indeed the state is inevitably going to spin everything. Absolutely.
Well, I would agree that maybe pure truth isn't possible, but I think there can be comparisons made. If you look at West Germany after World War II, I think on the whole they did a pretty admirable job of facing up to the facts of World War II, whereas many people say that in Japan that wasn't done so much. But, and, of course, the victors hardly ever face up to their their horrendous acts.
But now I hate to, my skepticism to start coming out as we're getting toward the end of our conversation, but here's the deep skepticism. You know, Germany after World War II was a ruined and wrecked society. Japan was a ruined and wrecked society. And there's no way forward except reconciliation. Iraq is a ruined and wrecked society, but there's nothing. It looks like it's becoming a ruined and wrecked society. There's nothing in its place. There's no civil society. There's just a collapse of order. So I don't know. I don't know how we could ever expect reconciliation on the current terms between, say, the Shias and the Sunnis and the Kurds with a foreign occupier there. It just seems to me a mess, right?
I agree with you. I think that the only hope that we have is a process in which such people could achieve such terms on themselves, and that is indeed quite dubious in itself. But with a foreign occupier there, the process becomes horrendous because the entire thing is slanted around the power of that occupier.
So, Daniel, on that note, we're going to have to thank you for joining us. It's been a real pleasure, and I hope to see you at the Humanity Center Fest this
weekend. You guys are great, and I also want to thank the Stanford Humanity Center. I have to do this. I had one of the most wonderful years of my life there. It is a great garden of research in the humanities and of conversation, just the kind of conversations we're having. Thank you all.
And that's thank you. And that's being said by the director of a rival humanity center. So there you go. So our guest has been Daniel Hurwitz, director of the Institute for the Humanities at the University of Michigan, formerly chair of the philosophy department and director of the Center for Knowledge and Innovation at the University of Natal in Durban, South Africa, author of a really fine book that I highly recommend to you called Race and Reconciliation, Essays from the New South Africa. So, John, what do you think?
I want to thank Daniel Hurwitz and all the callers that we didn't get a chance to talk to and a couple of emails we didn't get a chance to read, and the Humanities Center who helped bring us Professor Hurwitz to our show today. Well, I learned a lot about the facts of reconciliation. I learned that intelligent philosophers can take the ideas of Hegel and make sense out of some of these complex processes. The one idea I always liked of Hegel was this thesis, antithesis, synthesis. That does seem to me an extraordinary number of processes to which that applies. So maybe I'll go back and read the Phenomenology of the Spirit.
Well, that would be a fun thing to do. No, seriously. I mean, this is a fascinating topic, and I wish we had a bit more time because I really am deeply cynical about something. About, I think Iraq requires a massive process of reconciliation. Iraq is not a nation. It's not a nation. It's a bunch of people who have been at odds with one another, with one group dominating the other. We go in there and upset that thing. And I don't know that our going in makes possible, it seems to me, it doesn't make possible reconciliation among these people. It makes it less likely, less possible. So, you know,
I must say, I'm a little more optimistic because I think that there's always the question of what a really great man can do. I think Nelson Mandela was such a man, and I think Bishop Tutu was such a man.
That's true.
And I'm not sure that there isn't such a man in or a woman in Iraq because I don't think we get a very clear picture of some of these religious leaders. But on the other hand, I'm not at all sure that there is either. But I'm pretty sure an American isn't going to be that charismatic personality.
One hopes for Iraq's own Nelson Mandela. But here with the final word on reconciliation is Ian Scholes, the 62nd philosopher.
Ian Scholes, the concepts of personal forgiveness and reconciliation are central to Catholicism and Christianity in general. Jewish and Christian traditions also include the concept of corporate sin. That is, a tribe or nation can be collectively sinful. In the book of Daniel, for example, after God destroys Jerusalem, Daniel repents on behalf of Israel. And today, religion has added a kind of social reconciliation with congregations asking God's forgiveness for the perceived sins of a nation on every side of the political spectrum, from abortion to racism. In the 20th century, the scenarios of repentance and forgiveness seeking went global and secular. In 2000, the president of the West African nation of Benin apologized to African Americans for his country's ancestors' complicity in the slave trade. The notion of an American apology for slavery has been floated, as well as the official apology for the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II, both notions meeting with some controversy. The philosopher Jacques Derrida wrote one of his final essays on the concept of forgiveness. He considered it a paradox. If you forgive something that is actually forgivable, then forgiving has no meaning. So you can only forgive that which is unforgivable. And, he observed the new spate of global forgiveness, and with God no longer in the mix, if humanity charges itself with crimes against humanity, then humanity is both victim and tormentor. How can humanity testify against itself? The success of reconciliation in South Africa after years of racial division inspired other countries to take that process as a model. South Africa's reconciliation process is part of the Western tradition, of course, but there was something else there, something that bypassed Derrida's paradox, the Zulu ethic, central to Nelson Mandela's belief system, called Ubuntu. A person becomes a person through other people. Desmond Tutu wrote, quote, "A person with Ubuntu has a proper self-assurance that comes from knowing that he or she belongs in a greater whole and is diminished when others are tortured or oppressed. To forgive is not just to be altruistic. It is the best form of self-interest. What dehumanizes you inexorably dehumanizes me," unquote. Nelson Mandela believed that the spirit of Ubuntu, which infused the village culture in which he had been raised, had been destroyed by apartheid. It is a testament to the largeness of his spirit that when he took charge of South Africa, his goal was not to take revenge, but to rekindle that village spirit of Ubuntu. By framing reconciliation in distinctly African terms, Mandela was able to get the enthusiastic support not only of black South Africans, but idealistic young whites as well. I like to claim that I have Ubuntu, but unfortunately, I have a hard time letting go of a grudge. Speaking of paradoxes, I've got grudges older than I am. Forgive me. I gotta go.
Wow, Ken, my head is dizzy from 60 seconds of rapid-fire philosophy.
If your head is dizzy, that means you've got a conundrum in your mind, and we can solve it for you, can't we, John?
Yes. Go to our webpage,
conundrums@philosophytalk.org, or hit that conundrums button on the webpage. We won't promise to solve your problem, but we will give you lots of new ways to think about it.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University.
Our executive producer is Gordon Earle.
Special thanks to Rujun Shen, Nicole Sawaya, Ben Temption, and Alan Farley.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association.
Also from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW Information Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking. Thank you.